somebody who will help the programmer to write programs. And so ideally it will look like this, except there is one problem, that we cannot build fast enough keyboard to utilize the power of this automatic programmer. So the solution will have to look a little bit different. And to remind you at the high level, what is it that we try to achieve? It's let's look at how programming looks today. The programmer gets an insight of what he wants to implement. From that, he goes to sort of implementation mechanics, lower level details, and then he implements the program and does a validation, sort of testing, debugging. And either he's done, which usually doesn't happen on the first try, or there is an error, and the error could be in either the mechanics or, of course, in the high level insight. And either way, he needs to fix it and iterate until it's done. And I think the state of the art of the programming is that today we do have tools to help validation: automatic testers, model checker, verifiers of various degree of scalability, precision, guarantees of correctness, and so on. And what we want to do here is to extend this into implementation mechanics. We are not proposing that the insight will somehow be automatically generated by the system, although it might help in some cases as you play with the synthesizer. But at least if the lower level details we get right, that would be nice. So there are two key problems in doing this. And the first one is, how do you actually build a system, presumably a language, in which you can communicate that high level insight in such a way that the synthesizer can then fill in the details? And then there are these algorithmic problems of how we actually do the synthesis. And we talked yesterday about five systems that have different ways of communicating insight into the synthesizer, and we briefly mentioned what their algorithms are. And today I want to show you examples of how in the system that we've been working on you communicate that insight, and then what the algorithms underneath are. So the key observation in the system is that the insight and mechanics, at least in imperative programming, performance programming, are both present in the code, and they can often be distinguished. So syntactically distinguish what is inside and what is the mechanics, which simplify things. So then using one program, what we call the partial program, program that is incomplete, the programmer can specify the inside, and then the synthesizer completes the mechanics. So the sketch is really a partial program, just like it was in the other systems. So to remind you, there are just two simple constructs in that language, and essentially only one of them is the synthesis construct. And one way to present it is that you have a specification program which gives the behavior of what you implement. What is important is just the observable input-output behavior. And then you have this partial program, or let's call it the sketch, that contains holes. And the holes are built out of this elementary hole, the double question mark, which is completed with a constant. Depending on the type, Boolean, integer, list of integers that may initialize a table, and so on. And then the second construct is only used to link the behavior of these two programs, sorry, the bar and the foo. So that's it, and the result of synthesis here is a program where this double question mark hole is replaced with constant one, and that hypothetically could lead to a faster program. So, and of course you can use also assertions as a other way of adding safety guarantees, and this is your way of specifying correctness. So really, what it is, we now have a sort of system in which we can specify a partial program sketch, a specification, insist that they compute the same total function in our system, and we need to solve for h, which are the values of the holes that make the sketch behave like the spec. Effectively, they parameterize it to behave like a function that computes the specification. And the low-level hole, the one that's replaced by a constant, which is the only thing that the base language understands, doesn't seem very powerful. Of course, you saw yesterday how you can build high-level constructs on top of it with just syntactic sugar. It doesn't seem very powerful, but it already can be useful for interesting examples. So let me show you a program that a student did in a contest that we did in sketching. What he did, he wanted to implement a 4x4 matrix transpose. And he did it in a simulator, so performance was important. And he realized that, the machine on which I'm running, some Intel chip, had some SIMD instruction that you could potentially use to speed it up. So here is the specification of the system. He uses a 4x4 matrix here. It's flattened for reasons that are not so significant here, I think. But you see what it does. It iterates over rows, columns, and here it does this transport. It goes from M to T by switching rows and columns. And so that's the specification that was too slow for him. Then he realized, well, maybe I could use the SIMD instruction available to parallelize it. And here is that instruction. That instruction essentially performs two semi-permutations on vectors. So here is one input vector, here is another. And for each of them, you can specify how you shuffle these elements. So you pick two elements in each of the vectors, you specify where they go in the target, and that's your two semi-permutations that you do there. And there is a bit vector that specifies how, which of these permutations you pick. So here is a sketch that essentially captures his implementation idea. What he realizes is that he cannot do the transpose in essentially one phase. He needs to do it in two phases, which means he needs to compute an intermediate matrix. And then once he has that intermediate matrix in another phase, he can then finish the transpose. So here is the input matrix M, here is the resulting one, and here is the intermediate S, and here is phase one, and here is phase two. And what happens here, the repeat question mark is a macro that essentially replicates the body of that macro. How many times is decided by the synthesizer? So some number of times he needs to perform that shuffle. And that shuffle does what? It takes from the input matrix M some consecutive four words and another some consecutive four words. We don't know where they start, so this is the purpose of these holes there. The synthesizer will figure out where in that matrix you pick that thing, and then it selects appropriate bit vector, which is the appropriate semi-permutations for shuffling them the right way, and it writes it into this intermediate matrix, again at a location that the student didn't know. And then once we have S, we do the same thing into the target matrix, which we return. So that's essentially his idea, and in about 20 minutes, the synthesizer comes back and gives you this program which implements that specification that you saw as these two nested loops on the previous side. And what you see here is that, well, according to what he said in the email, it took him about half a day to figure it out manually the summer before when he did it without the synthesizer. The synthesizer does it maybe 30 minutes, maybe less now. And so if you are familiar with how to write these partial programs and you can write this quickly, then you significantly improve his productivity. And so this is the code that, of course, you would rather not write by hand, but this is one example. So of course, these low-level holes is not what you always need. Sometimes the inside has a higher-level form. You could say, you want to complete a hole with a particular syntactic form, and it could be an index expression. So using an array, and you don't know what the index should be, but you know it's some sort of affine expression of I and J. So you could write it that way, of course. You could write polynomials this way. But all these forms don't need to be spelled out in this naive way. You can write what we call generators for them. And they will look like grammars. Now, imagine you want to generate expressions of this form. So you say, I know I have a hole, and what needs to be there is an expression that is from this set of expressions. So you can write it like this. So what you notice is that this is a recursive function, and the inline here is sort of anachronism construct that we use to show that when you call itself recursively, you get a fresh copy of that function, and that simply means that this hole here is a distinct hole in each recursive invocation. So now you see how this recursive function essentially encodes a grammar. Right? Depending on what the synthesizer chooses here, in this point, this function is replaced with A if it is zero, or it can be replaced with B, or with addition over something that recursively the synthesizer selects. So the values that the synthesizer chooses here determine what is a call to expression from the main program replaced with. And of course, these here mean nothing, just the control over which of these grammatical production in this grammar is chosen by the synthesizer. So here is an example for you to think about. So by now you should understand what this code does. I'll grab my coffee in the meantime. So anybody knows what we are synthesizing here. It's not quite a programming problem. We are abusing the system to do something different. Factoring a polynomial, exactly. So here is a specification which computes a polynomial. Here is a sketch. We know that because it implements the specification. And here are two terms, one, another one. And here is our hole, which says, fill it with a polynomial over x of a degree up to 3. And here is this generator for the polynomial, which has the same structure as before. It recursively calls itself in each iteration. It finds a constant, a coefficient for the polynomial, and it ends with a constant here. So that's it. And so we can do these generators even without any need for metavariables, because essentially, the binding just happens naturally by replacing that function in the code with a suitable simplified version. So you can think of it as the goal of the synthesizer is to find values here that give you a correct program, and then a partial evaluator takes care of cleaning up the stuff that can be evaluated at compile time. So therefore, you get here a nice compact form of the polynomial rather than this recursive invocation. So this is a rather standard thing. So other higher-level constructs that you can do on top of that elementary hole is a reorder, which finds a suitable order of these statements. This is useful, remember, especially in the concurrent data structures, where if the threads modify shared memory, then the order in which they do it is important. The synthesizer finds an order that gives you a correct concurrent program. Here is essentially a more compact encoding what you saw. You are asking in this hole to find an expression from this regular expression grammar, so A or B or C, optionally followed by next. And there are probably a few others that we have. So another example of how you could use it is, let's do merge sort. Let's first do it by hand without any synthesis. So you know what happens, it's merge sort. You split the array in two halves, you recursively sort them, and then you need to merge the results. The merge routine is not too much worse than that. You iterate over these two arrays. In each iteration, you compare the top of the two elements, and depending on the outcome of that comparison, you append the top of one or the other array into the resulting array. And so this looks simple enough, but there is a bug in this code. Can anybody spot the bug? The size of the array is so this is we should pass here n over 2. Yeah, so I think this should be n over 2 here, you're right. But that's not the bug I had in mind. Yeah, that was probably corrected in some of the later versions of the slide, but I picked a wrong one. So this is clearly a bug. But there is one that is a bit trickier to spot. Exactly, right? So eventually one or the other array becomes empty, and you need to modify this condition in such a way that you then start picking things in the other from the other array. And of course, if you use a functional language, then those sort of base cases are easier to write. But if you want to tweak performance, you want to have really control over how your memory looks, and you sometimes have to resort to writing code like this. And so the bug is here, and the correct condition for here looks like this. So this is code that not even a grad student should have to write. So you would rather synthesize it. So what you would like to do instead, you say, well, I know that perhaps you first write it by hand, there is a bug, and then you say, I would like to synthesize what comes here. And, well, there is a metaphoric picture here. You can see here you have a sketch. you want to get an implementation in all the hairy details, and you do it by giving the synthesizer also a spec, because of course without the spec it has no basis for knowing how to complete the program. And so the spec here could be, say, a bubble sort or something that you can write quickly. It could also be a check of what does it mean to be correct. It must be a permutation and sorted, but probably a simple sort is easier to write than a declarative specification of correctness. And so here is how that sketch could look like. Essentially, you would say, well, I want some expression over some operators here, and perhaps you list the variables, or you really the values that might appear in this expression. And so this highlights two things about how we do synthesis. And the first one is that the programmer has control over the synthesized code. So you know they're allowing the synthesizer to generate just about anything, and therefore come up with a surprising code that the programmer doesn't want. It does what you want, but doesn't look like what you want, and is potentially slower. So the programmer can essentially specify a language that is completed that is used to complete the whole. And another highlight is that you have control over the values that can go into that expression. In particular, by saying, I know that the division operator is only used to come up with the value n over half. And it's not used in any other way. And therefore, you are helping the scalability of synthesizer. You didn't add the division operator here. You are using it only here. And by doing that, you are manually, using your insight, pruning the space of candidate implementations, making the system more scalable. If this is still too slow, you could think a little bit harder and reduce the space by massaging the whole. So by doing that, we have some control over what is synthesized. So here is the result. And the final example I want to show you is what is called a stencil. It's a matrix kernel that is often used in computer vision, games, engineering simulations, partial differential equations. And what it does, it computes this element, say here, from the values of these two elements here, and it does it the default version, you could think of it as specification, with the traversal that we have just seen. But that gives you poor cache behavior, because the values that you write into the cache, by the time the loop goes all the way to the end, are displaced from the cache, and then when you move one row up, that's not in the cache anymore, and therefore it needs to bring it to the cache, and so on. So a better version traverses like this. So notice that the value that has been just written in the top of this triangle is going to be read again. And therefore, you use cache locality, and the loop runs faster. The result of this optimization, however, is that now you have two corner cases, right, that correspond to these two loops that behave differently than the steady state, which is in the middle. And so now the code is significantly more complicated, and this is what they call a one-dimensional matrix. Essentially, it works on a one-dimensional array in a few time steps. Typically, these stencils are 2, 3, or 4-dimensional. In 3 dimensions, instead of two corner cases, you may get 16, or maybe it's 24. So it would be nice if you didn't have to write it by hand. And the tricky things here, you could say, you could probably make abstracted a little bit higher, but to help the programmer, you could already say these indices, the loop bounds, is what is tricky here, the things that are underlined. So let's synthesize those. So you leave the holes for those. Of course, you don't do it like this, but you specify essentially the following. You say, I need some linear expression here over n and 4 that's used in the outer loop, and the inner loop uses a linear expression of n, 4, and I, which is the variable in the outer loop, and then the synthesizer comes up with the result that you saw before. So here are examples of how we use that systems to write partial programs and synthesize them. And this may be a good time to stop and discuss the power of the language, convenience, inconvenience, because I'd like to transition and start talking about the algorithms for completing these programs.
I have a question. You had an inline function, right?
Yes.
And it was written in a recursive manner. Should it be recursive always, or is it possible to call other functions in inline function?
You can call other functions, and it is recursive, but if you remember that recursion, let's go back. So we are here, right? That recursion is controlled by the synthesizer. Okay, so essentially, when we ask the synthesizer to find a candidate program, implicitly we are asking the synthesizer to find a program that terminates. So the synthesizer will eventually need to terminate this recursion by calling this or calling that. So you can think of it as that's the contract with the synthesizer. Because if this really, you could think of it as a recursion that happens at code generation time, right? The synthesizer inlines this as much as necessary to generate appropriate expression. So you could think of it also, it's in his interest to actually terminate the code generation rather than giving you a program that is unbounded. Yes, so that's a good comment.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to validate my your synthesized program using bounds sort on the huge array, or?
Well, so first of all, it is used in validation. It's also used in the synthesis itself. We are going to do that next, but I want to answer the question. So it's used both in validation and synthesis. And if you give me a huge array, well, what does it mean to give me a huge array? If you tell me that you want my synthesizer to validate correctness on all arrays of up to a given size, and that given size is really large, then I'm in trouble. I cannot do it. Then I would need to use a verifier that has enough domain knowledge about sorting algorithm that it can really look at what is synthesized and prove that it is correct. And people are starting to build such verifiers that they can do it off the shelf. But using bounded model checking, which is what we use, on inputs of really large size would not work. The hope is that, and that has been empirically proven, but what we saw that usually the small world hypothesis works in our favor, that in model checking, the small world hypothesis says that all the bugs that exist in the system, or most of them, can be found by exploring inputs of small size. And essentially, we are saying you can not only synthesize on small size, but then doing the checking that it is correct can be done on small size. Yeah, so that's a limitation just like of any other verification systems.
So take your the cache locality example you brought up, Stencil.
Mm-hmm.
Once the validator comes back and says, here's your solution, is it also going to provide some justification or some intuitive reason as to why the solution is the correct one, or is it just the case that says, well, here's the constants that actually work. I don't know why they work.
So we should start moving to the algorithms, and since these are the questions. For the case of the stencil, we actually have a proof that it is correct on all possible inputs, and I'll show you how it is. And the system is not designed to give you a proof, but in principle it could give you a proof that it is correct. But it is not a deductive proof in terms of showing you some invariant. In the case of the stencil, you'll see we know how to, using some domain knowledge, reduce it into a program that is bounded, uses bounded number of inputs. And if you prove that correct, then it is correct. And perhaps looking at that reduced program may help you, but no, the goal is not to give you the insight. But let's come back to the question once we understand what the algorithms are. Okay, so we are now here. We want to understand the algorithms for synthesis. Let me just do one other thing. Okay, so we are now here. And the algorithm that I want to show you is that is the basis of most synthesis we do. We have other algorithms based on backtracking search, which are not as scalable and useful for sort of playing with the system. But this is the one that scales best so far and has some innovations that probably advance the state of the verification also. So how do we synthesize? It works in five steps. We first turn the controls, the holes in the program, into control inputs of the program. So the transformation is really simple. Essentially, we have a sketch with two holes. You lift them up to become arguments of the function. But what you want to really think about it now is that, this partial program here defines syntactically a space of candidate implementations in which you are searching for a program that is correct, and you are searching by looking for suitable values of these controls. And if we come back to your question about what about recursion, these inline functions are recursive functions are inline, and you can really think of it as that's done for the purpose of getting a fresh copy of the hole in each iteration to give you effectively grammatical way of deriving some strings. And so in principle, it is unbounded, but of course we want to synthesize bounded programs. So the way it really happens inside is that we unroll the program enough that the synthesizer can find a program that is correct. And if it's not enough, you can unroll some more. But at the higher level, you can think of it that the synthesizer is smart enough to use such values in the recursion that the recursion eventually terminates. In second step, you translate the spec and sketch to Boolean functions. Now, of course, in order to do it, we need to do the bounded model checking trick, which is we assume that the small world of inputs is sufficient, and we bound the program. And so bounded program is one that executes in bounded number of steps. And one way to do it is that you bound the size of the input and you work with programs that always terminate. And so in the domains that we're interested in, that always is the case. So how then the translation happens to these Boolean functions? Well, I'll show you how to convert it into a circuit, and then how to get from a circuit to a function is obvious. So what do we have here? So here we have an input array, really a bit vector x, and we have a count variable which counts the number of one bits in that bit vector, and you iterate some number of times, you check the appropriate bit, increment the count. Now if you see what happens here it's an imperative program, but you turn it into a functional program, of course, so you have multiple versions of the count variable, one after each iteration. Here is the resulting value. Now so what is here is one iteration of the loop. You check the appropriate value of the bit, and depending on whether it is 1 or 0, you either propagate the value of the count or you increment it by 1. That's it. And then you return the final value. So here is a program that has been made acyclic by unrolling the loop a certain number of times and then turning the imperative program into functional one, and that's essentially it. And now, once we have spec and sketch converted into Boolean functions, we can see how to formulate the constraint satisfaction problem that really is our way of solving the synthesis problem. So we put these two together, the spec and the sketch. So here is the spec and here is the sketch. And we put them together like this, essentially saying, well, on all inputs, they better output the same value, and we are looking for C in such a way that this output is always true, right? In other words, we have the following constraint satisfaction problem. We are looking for some values of holes such that on all possible inputs, this function and that function parameterized by C compute the same value. Right? So importantly, this C here is chosen before we see the input. We are not looking for C that is here. Right? So we are not first asking to see the input and then look for the value of C, but instead we look for a C such that on all inputs this is correct. So now, if you work with constraint satisfaction, you immediately realize that this is a hard problem because there is quantifier alternation. And why that is a problem, you can really think of it as, well, naively, there are two searches going on. Here, there is an outer loop that searches all possible values of C. Here is an inner loop that, for a particular C, checks whether that C is correct on all possible values of X. And this cross product of these two searches for x and over all x's makes it really hard. So therefore, we cannot just solve the problem naively by enumerating both c's and x's, and we turn to inductive synthesis. So this brings us to step 4, which is the use of counterexample guided search to solve that problem. So first, what is inductive synthesis? Inductive synthesis, an old idea that came from AI, is to synthesize a program, or really a function, that computes a function that you have in mind, a function that you may not know. If I give you a few examples, these examples are called observations, they could come in the form of input and output. The inductive synthesizer is supposed to give you a function that agrees with these observations. So on those inputs, computes those outputs. And hopefully in all the other inputs, it computes also the stuff that you have in mind, but you haven't presented it to the inductive synthesizer. So it generalizes from these observations to something that agrees with those observations, and hopefully with others that you have not seen. So you induce a function. And it was used in algorithmic debugging of Prolog programs by Shapiro and Ades, then in inductive logic programming. Programming by example can be thought of being of that kind. So what are the big issues here that we want to solve? Well, the first one is convergence, of course. If I give you a few observations, and then you give me a program that agrees with those observations, how do I know that you actually converge to a program that would be correct on all the other inputs? So that's the first problem we need to solve. Second, obviously not observations are equal. You know, you can give me a million observations, but if they only exercise one aspect of the program, but not all the others, if they don't exercise all the other corner cases, then these observations are probably as good as having just one. And finally, even if once we settled on the inductive synthesis, which is the scalability innovation here, it's still not clear how you can, from a small number of observations, generate a program that agrees with them in an efficient way. Because that space of candidate programs, remember, is really large. So even if you eliminated that for all X search, that problem remains hard. So here is how this algorithm works. And now we'll have answers to two of these questions. So we call it counterexample-guided inductive synthesis, and it starts as follows. You have this inductive synthesizer, which, given a few inputs, computes a candidate program that is correct on those inputs. So you give it the set of observations, really inputs, and it either fails, so it could already figure out that I cannot find a program in your candidate space, meaning I cannot complete your partial program that is correct on all of those inputs. Or it will succeed and give you a candidate implementation. It's not necessarily correct. It's only correct on those observations. And now you put your verifier, checker, whatever you have in here. And now the correctness we give you is as strong as what you can put here. And you can put here anything, including one that is potentially interactive with the human. In fact, a human could be here. The human could look at the program that they synthesized as it was in the prospector system I showed yesterday, and say, yes, this is what I want or not. This could be a tester that has a test suite that is bigger than this. It could be a random tester. The only observation, the only requirement here is that it, when the thing fails, when it's okay, you are done, and if it fails, you get a counterexample input that is a witness to the fact that the program that you generated is not correct or not yet correct, because the inductive synthesizer does not have enough observations yet. And it needs to be bounded rather than a formula that corresponds to an unboundedly large executions because of how we build this constraint system, and I'll show you soon how it is. Essentially, it actually can be explained. We really need to build a formula that corresponds to the execution of the program, and therefore we need a bounded input so that that formula is bounded and can be turned into a Boolean function. So anything comes here, but we use typically a bounded model checker. In fact, when you saw how we convert a program into a Boolean function, this is how the checking happens here in the default systems that we use. You turn it into a Boolean function, and you ask whether there exists any input on which the synthesized program fails. So this is essentially it, and both this and that is in our system implemented with a SAT solver. Remember, the original problem exists for C for all X is not a SAT problem, but now each of these is a SAT problem. And now we have essentially two communicating SAT problems talking to each other, exchanging candidate programs and counterexamples, essentially inputs on which the program that has been synthesized so far fails. So what have we done? So the inductive synthesizer, of course, could be adversarial. It could give you a program that is not bad. It's only correct on those few observations, but it's totally nonsensical on the others. After all, a general inductive synthesizer could just produce a table that looks up these values and outputs the correct value there. So how do we deal with that? Well, you give it a sketch, so it cannot do that, right? The sketch constrains it to a particular set of programs, and all the inductive synthesizer can do is find the appropriate parameters, appropriate holes for the sketch. So by doing that, you prevent it from being adversarial. How do you find convergence? Well, you use that checker. You use the synthesis on a few inputs, but the checker looks at either all of the domain of interest or some much larger space, still a small world, and that's how it does the checking, and that's how you do convergence. And perhaps the most interesting observation is that the counterexample, the witnesses that the program synthesized so far is incorrect, have extremely important value. Because if you look here, if you find a candidate that is not yet correct, the witness to the incorrectness of the candidate uncovers a corner case that these observations don't yet cover. So by doing that, by growing the set of observations, you are exploring in a really parsimonious way parts of the executions or part of the functionality that has not been covered yet. And by doing that, these sets of inputs really form an abstraction of the particular problem. And what is important is that even though the input space for these programs may be really large, even if you bound it, it could be 2 to the 100, for example. Right? You may work with inputs that really contain 100 bits or more. The set of observations here is very small, typically a few tens. So compare that with 2 to the 100. So this is the value of inductive synthesis and the value of using this counterexample that expose gradually the corners of the desired functionality. So here is an example of how the inductive synthesizer gradually converges to a correct program. So what we want to implement here is a removal from a doubly linked list. So not particularly easy program to write if you're a beginner. And so we'll solve it by saying, OK, we'll write the following sketch. And each of these things is a hole. Here is a hole that gives you some predicate over these two pointers, L and N. And here is another hole that gives you a range of assignments from N to L. And you'll see soon what they are. And we write the following correctness specification. You could say it's not very strong, but this is enough, actually, to generate the correct program. So what it does, we have a list, and we have a list of nodes here. We initialize the list such that the nodes from this list here are inserted into this list. And now, depending on the argument P, which is what the synthesizer has control over, we remove that particular node. And then we check that indeed that node was appropriately removed. So this is our correctness condition. And we test it on a particular executions that initialize the list and then just remove. So imagine that you have only one observation. So the counterexample obtained from the first one you actually obtain randomly. So imagine that 3 is the first random observation. And here is a program that the synthesizer computes. It is one of the programs that is correct on p equals 3. So p points somewhere in the middle of the list. And this code here is sufficient to perform the removal in the middle of the list. But the synthesizer, the checker on the right, does the check and realizes, OK, so that didn't work for p equals 0. And now when these are our two observations, now we get a program that is correct for both p equals 3 and p equals 0. But the checker says, oh, it's still not equal for the end of the list. And now with these three observations, you get a program that is correct. And the whole solving process takes less than a second. So you could write interactively this program by spitting out essentially this sketch and then writing a test harness, which you should really have anyway in agile programming, and obtain this code automatically. So to summarize synthesis is a generalized set. It's generalized in the sense that you don't have one quantifier, but you have two. And this is called a 2QBF problem. There are off-the-shelf solvers, but what we have done is more scalable for the particular system because of how we build these counterexamples. And so here are these two solvers again. One is that you synthesize for a particular set of inputs. If you cannot find a solution, then the sketch is buggy, and here you verify the candidate C, whether it's correct for all the inputs of interest. And if it is not, you get a counterexample which you add to the list of observations, and you continue. Now, the problem here is a set problem, because what we are really doing, we have these concrete inputs on which we evaluate both the specification, F, and the sketch, S, leaving the C to be the unknowns. And we have a conjunction here of these equalities for all inputs, for all observations, and essentially looking for C such that on all these inputs, the spec and the sketch agree. And here is the checking problem where you have a fixed C and the X is the unknown, and we are looking for such an X such that the sketch and the spec compute a different value. So here a solution to the satisfiability is value of X on which the candidate C disagrees with the spec. Here are the two set problems. Finally, when you have a C, you just, the values of C, you plug it into the system, and there you have it. So what were the alternatives to doing it this way? Well, we could, instead of having a sketch, just say, look at all the programs in the given language, presumably in increasing size or other such heuristic, and use some sort of checker to find a good one. And for the concurrent list, that would give us a space of about that many. That's, if you check it in one CPU cycle, unrealistic, that probably takes a while, then you can wait. Now, so option one is to reduce that space with a sketch, which constrains that space. For that sketch, that would be 10 to the 9, so relatively small. And with 1 second validation, you get to about that many days. And now with the CGS algorithm, which uses the inductive synthesis, rather than look at all candidates described by the sketch, you do it in about 1 minute in about 3 iterations. So these numbers are a little bit, so all you need are 3 inputs to find the correct candidate in that space of candidates. Absolutely. So the worst case is, it could look at all inputs in the worst case, absolutely, yes. So here is how it scales. So here is the number of counterexamples you need. It's essentially the number of iterations of the CGS algorithm as a function of the size of the candidate space. So this is in the log of the candidate space. And it scales pretty linearly in the number. Effectively, this is the number of bits you need to represent that space. You can really think of it roughly as the number of bits you need to represent the holes in that sketch. So, of course, this is not linear time. It gets exponentially slower. But at least the number of iterations that you need is proportional to the size of that candidate space. And it scales actually much higher like this. And this is the largest program that we've of 10 to the 2400. So this is essentially the basic algorithm. What I want to do next is show how, for at least one domain, we were able to prove correctness for all possible inputs, not just some bounded space of inputs. And then I'll talk a little bit about how the synthesis is done for the concurrent programs, which changes the problem quite a bit. I see. Okay. So this is important. Let's go back. All right. So first of all, how do you actually generate that final program? This inductive synthesizer receives a set of inputs. We call them observations because that's traditionally inductive synthesis. And what it does, it gives you a program that is correct on all those inputs. And what we mean by that, it gives you values of holes such that if you plug them into the sketch, you effectively parameterize the sketch into a program, that program is correct on those inputs, which means it computes what the specification computes.
But how this program is generated?
How this program? You take these values of holes computed by this guy and effectively just plug it into the values of those holes. If there was a recursion, you unroll it appropriately. You run partial evaluation to effectively clean up the things that were the artifacts of writing the recursive generators. And the resulting code is still a function of X, the normal input. The C has been hard-coded into the program. That's your code. And how these counterexamples are factored into the resulting code? Well, they are not factored directly. They are only used to force the inductive synthesizer to give you a candidate that is correct on those inputs. And you hope on the you hope also on the others, and then that hope is checked here by that checker. Please.
Is there a rule of thumb for even a particular sketch how many bits are going to be in the space?
What is the maximum number of bits that we can handle in the sort of the scalability sense, you mean?
I mean, if I've written up some sketch, and I just want to have a feel for
How many? Well, so that's usually syntactically obvious because you leave a hole and you know whether this is a Boolean hole or not, so it's one bit. If it's an integer, then as many as you need for integer, what we do a trick of gradually growing the number of bits to represent the integers because most integers, most of these holes have values of up to 10, 16 or so, so the usual trick. But you can see that if you follow the algorithm of gradually increasing it, how many bits you need. If you have a generator that recursively unrolls, again, you know that you probably need unrolling of 2, 3 at most. So that's how you can compute it. So that estimate can be done even before you do the synthesis itself. The challenge is that of estimating how long it would take is that some sketches are less scalable than others. You can really think of them as, well, if these holes are independent, meaning that you find an input on which you can compute one hole and then you find another input on which you compute the others, perfect, you can have many such holes in the program. If you have an execution where the value of this hole influences what the other one needs to compute, so you have sort of this deep chain, then the set solver needs to work really hard. It does the simplification that it can, then it backstrack a little bit, the combination of solving and backtracking. Then it may take a long time. So the only thing I can tell you about scalability is that are these values here, that the size of the candidate space, essentially the number of bits needed to represent the holes, will correspond to the number of iterations. So this is essentially how many times you run that set solver, the inductive synthesizer and the checker. But how long they run can vary widely depending on the complexity of the program. So the time, therefore, is not shown here. But most of the programs we work are essentially interactive, so it's a few seconds a minute. This one here was the AES crypto kernel where we synthesized 32,000 bits. There are various lookup tables. And this one finished in maybe half an hour now, maybe 20 minutes. And but the alternative here would be to write, understand the domain of the permutations and Galois fields and write yourself a sort of code generator of these programs. In our case, you don't need any such things. You just write a partial program that's completed for you. Let's do more questions maybe before I go on. If there are more questions. Andrzej. Well, I don't know exactly what the division is, but in the case of the concurrent sketch, the checker was not a set solver, but the spin model checker. And so that took a while. And then a lot of time was spent communicating between them, because now we didn't have two set solvers, but one spin checker and one our set solver. And just moving the files along was costly. But the inductive synthesis was also quite expensive. In that case too, you know, because of concurrency, things just get harder by another dimension. That's the thread interleaving. Let's say roughly half between spin and us, maybe. The good thing is that you only needed three observations to do it, and then you were done. So essentially, there wasn't a chance for the set problem to become really expensive by adding more conjunction to it. Okay. So I want to tell you how we do it for one class of unbounded problems. So first, let me give you an overview. So this is for the stencils. So by default, what we do, we synthesize, we finitize the sketch by bounding it under all loops, under all recursions, some bounding of number time, turn it into a circuit, we are done. For the stencils, what happens, stencil is a function that is unbounded because it has arrays of arbitrary size on input. It returns an array of arbitrary size, and we convert it into a function that faithfully represents it, but it works on inputs of a bounded size. And the reduction actually computes a symbolic slice of the program, and I'll show you how. And that's done without any loss of precision, so all the holes are preserved. You complete these reduced programs, and therefore it's complete and sound, and so the holes computed on the reduced programs can be plugged in into the original one. So that was done for these stencils. And admittedly, that reduction is a domain theory. You had to understand what these programs look like. You had to delineate a domain for which you did it. But compared to writing and optimizing compiler for that domain, that was much simpler. And it's more general. Of course, an optimizing compiler, a good one, will do magic, and we still have to write the sketch. But typically, we can synthesize stuff that they cannot compile. Okay. So the concurrent ones I'll skip for now. And let's go here to stencils. So here is a stencil. So here is a program that iterates over this unbounded array in one dimension. Here is the loop that's unbounded. And this program is unbounded because this loop iterates unbounded number of steps. And therefore, there is also it operates on potentially unbounded data, which is this input here. The good news is that there is what we call a stencil property in this domain of the programs. And the stencil property is that even though the overall computation here has an unbounded number of steps, each output, right, so each element in the output matrix is computed in a bounded number of operations, and therefore must use a bounded number of input elements. So if we could somehow express the computation for each of these guys, and any of these guys symbolically, then we have a program that is bounded because it has bounded number of steps, and therefore we can represent it as a Boolean formula. In fact, one without quantifiers is a circuit, and feed it into existing synthesizer. So here is how it is done. So here is our original stencil. What we want is to find a program that computes this element here, but any element, depending on the arguments u and v. So we write a function here that receives this input. It's still unbounded. We'll bound it at the very end. And now it has these arguments u and v. Now, what happens? Well, that value is computed differently, that value of the output matrix, depending where you are in these regions, right? If you are at the boundary here, so if this is your boundary condition, then you just return the input. If you are in a different space of the matrix, then what do? You recursively compute the stencil, right? You take the value of u of x, u minus 1, v minus 1, plus this one. So you essentially recursively get the other values. And the recursion is shown here. So if you care about this value, you first need to figure out what this is and what that is. If you care about that one, then you first need to do this. And recursively, all the goes all the way down. So you can replace these references to x and x here with references to this function itself with slightly different, appropriately modified indices. And that's it. Now, if you do a symbolic solving on it, what do you realize? That because this recursion is bounded by 4, this is how stencil operations work, that you perform a small number of time steps at a time in the various simulations, you get these various cases. Now, I'm omitting 5, but what is important that in all these cases, what we have a condition, essentially a region of the matrix, and now we know how the result is computed in terms of references to the input arrays. And they are still in terms of u and v, which is the index here, which is what, which output element you want, but each of them touches only a bounded number of inputs. So each of these cases, when you look at it, has only a bounded number of inputs elements that it reads, and there are well-known tricks how to bound that. Effectively, you use uninterpreted functions to model the inputs. So now we have a reduced version of this original program. And sort of a simple symbolic solver, which encapsulates the domain knowledge, was able to break down the various cases. Effectively, what it has done, it has identified the various regions of the matrix that behave differently, but it also kept as one equivalence class, essentially. I think this entire thing would be one equivalence class. This would be another, and this would be another. So it kept as one equivalence class all those elements that use the same expression to compute the output. And by doing that, it collapsed the unbounded number of computation steps into a bounded formula. So it nicely split all the cases for us. And you can do it even if the program contains holes. They just carry over to the resulting program. And here's an example that shows how to do it. So essentially what we have done, we took a SPEG and a sketch, performed this reduction, eliminated unboundedness, were able to get a circuit just like before, and called this what we call combinatorial solver because it uses SAD rather than deduction. You get resulting implementation, which are holes that you can back plug in into this program there. So you start with stencils that are unbounded loops and arrays, and you remove them away, and then the solving proceeds as before. So this is for arguably just one domain on how to do it. How to do it for other domains is not always clear. And that's really where the insight comes. And we don't really have yet a general approach of looking at the domain and doing such a reduction. So in general, how we solve problems is by bounding them, bounding their size. So one other thing that I want to conclude with is how we actually do solving for concurrent programs. Okay. So the problem with concurrent programs, as you can imagine, is that when you synthesize a candidate program, you send it to your checker. I mentioned that we use the spin model checker, but you could use any other. What will be the witness that you get back? If the program is incorrect, the witness could be the input, but usually there needs to be something else that you obtain from the checker. That witness will be sort of a schedule or a trace which shows under which interleaving of threads of that program a bug was exhibited. So we can, in fact, simplify the problem and say, let's assume that that concurrent program has no input X. All inputs are hard-coded. And all we care about is that you get the correct output under all possible interleavings of the threads that the program creates. That makes the program general enough for us. So the problem is that the checker gives you now a trace or a schedule, but that schedule is not really suitable as an observation for the inductive synthesizer. In the sequential case, the observation was an input that was valid for all candidate programs. Now we get a trace which shows the interleaving of instructions, but this is interleaving of instructions that come from one particular candidate program. So when I give you a sketch, depending on how you parameterize it, the resulting programs could have some statements and not have others, and the other candidate could have these statements and not have the others. So the thread that you come from one candidate is totally incomparable. Well, not totally. At least partially incomparable with the other. And remember what these counterexamples do. They capture a bug, you could say, that was found by the checker in the candidate program. You can think of it as a bug. You can think of it as the checker found a corner case that the inductive synthesizer didn't yet consider. So these counterexamples are extremely valuable. So when we find a trace, we really would like to somehow generalize it to other candidates in that space so that the inductive synthesizer can really use it to prune out that space of candidates. Now, how to do it is not obvious, but we have something that, by a reasonable metric of optimality, come close to that metric. So here is what we do. Essentially, what you want to do is take a trace that you obtain on a program P and somehow project it on program P prime. So we have two programs. P is the one on which we did the checking, and the checker said it's not good, and here is a trace capturing statement interleaving on which there was some assertion violation. And here is another program, P prime, that the inductive synthesizer may want to consider as another correct candidate. And so what we want to do, we take this trace on generating program P and map it on program P prime. Because then the inductive synthesizer can check, is this program P correct on that other trace, on the one that is mapped onto P prime? And if it is not, then that candidate will never be considered. It will be effectively pruned out. Now, what we really want is that if P prime shares the bug with P, in other words, if that trace exposed in P something that went wrong, showed some interleaving that led to assertion violation, we would like that to be also shared in P prime. So that mapping should expose that bug as well. So how this is done? So in sequential programs, what we are doing? Well, we have a set of inputs. These are our observations. And we are looking for C such that for all these axes, but this is a bounded set, so effectively we do not have this quantifier here, the sketch executing on this C is correct. So the safe thing here simply means that no assertion is violation. It's the same thing as if you said that it computes the same thing as the spec. In concurrent programs, we want to do the following. We again want to look for C. We have a bunch of traces. Each of them was generated on a particular candidate program, so these are specific to that program. And what we want? We want to make sure that the execution of that new candidate is safe on all these traces. But what do we want to do with them? We want to take these traces, map them to a particular candidate, right? This is the sketch parameterized by C is that candidate. But this is not very, the way this is written is not really friendly to the SAT synthesizer. Because what this really means is that you take the Boolean formula that is parameterized by C, somehow corresponds to the program. You first need to parameterize it, obtain a program, then map it to the traces that you obtained from the previous programs, and then you can decide whether it is safe or not. So that would really sort of destroy the efficiency of the SAT solving, which can look at these huge spaces of programs essentially at once. So we have a construction that does the following. It essentially changes the associativity of this and that. And what it takes the trace obtained on a particular program and embeds it into the sketch. So now we take a sketch, somehow embed that trace in it in such a way that depending how you parameterize it, which candidate you choose, that trace is appropriately mapped into that candidate. And now we have a problem that looks just like it did before. You have a partial program with the trace embedded in it, and the SAT solver can view it as a constraint satisfaction, looking for C that all these traces are correct. And I could show you how this is done, but this is not so particularly interesting as to show how one can embed traces into the program, again, obtaining a nice, efficient problem solving. Not as efficient as sequential, but close to that. All of it is correct except for abstract. There is nothing abstract there. This is all done on concrete semantics. And that's perhaps because we care about correctness that is not abstracted. We care about correctness of the concrete execution rather than of some partial property. But otherwise, you're right. Essentially, what you say, you embedded this trace into the sketch in such a way that depending then on C, the schedule automatically happens in such a way that as much of the trace is preserved into the new candidate as possible. If you're interested, I can show you an example how that happens, but this is probably all the point that I want to make. So I would stop here and take more questions if people have more questions.
You mentioned your approach is more scalable compared to others.
Yes, okay, so let me, okay, so this is probably a good point to mention it. So let me give you some background. We use SAT solving for the inductive synthesis, achieving reasonable scalability. We were hoping that as we switch to SMT solvers, which combine essentially the SAT decision procedure with specialized decision procedures such as bit vectors, integer arithmetic, and so on, that it will scale much better. And in, after a year of twiddling with it, we still cannot get SMT to perform better than SAT. In some cases, the performance of these two is matched. And so then we started investigating how come our performance is so much better, and we realized that we do a few things that exploit the small world hypothesis probably more than other people do. In particular, the way we translate integers into Boolean functions is not by the classical binary encoding. Instead, the encoding is unary and sparse. So you can think of it to the first degree that instead of binary, if the integer can range between 1 and 20, then you have 20 bits. Okay? And then you go one step further, and rather than keeping all those 20 bits, out of which one exactly needs to be 1, you use a sparse encoding where you associate the sort of statically a value with each bit, and only those bits are represented that may ever be 1. So if you know by some static analysis that, the integer is goes either 1 or 2 or 10 or 57, then you would have only 4 bits in its representation. And not only that often leads to a smaller number of bits, sometimes it doesn't, because sometimes you need more bits than the binary encoding. What you gain is that when you, for example, do indexing into an array, with the binary encoding, you would need to have a demultiplexer that takes the binary encoding and demultiplexes it into appropriate bits, effectively changes it into unary encoding so that you can pick the appropriate value from this array. And since we don't use the binary encoding, you pay for the representation somewhere else, but then all these operations become much faster. And this is probably why the SAT solver doesn't need to do such deep backtracking, because it doesn't need to go through these demultiplexing circuits. And therefore, the problems become easier to solve. So that may be the major source of the benefit.
And it's the way that you encode. It's not the way that you find the candidate programs or the way that you integrate the counterexamples.
I think the way of integrating counterexample is novel too, but there isn't much comparison. I think there are no other projects that pose the synthesis problem the way we do, so it's hard to see how our algorithms would scale since nobody solves that particular problem. We have observed things that sort of verification people observe later, that the SAT problems become easier to solve if you give it a few concrete examples. For example, people use SAT solvers to synthesize formulas, and they observe that, well, even though all the knowledge that you need to synthesize the formula with the SAT problem is encoded in the formula, it helps when you give it a few extra pieces of information, and that is some examples of the execution. Because then the SAT solver has a few clues from which it can do its deduction internally much better. And so you could say that, well, we do nothing else but solving from such concrete inputs, which are these observations. And so we use that observation too. That's probably, I think, the key points about the comparison. Well, thank you very much. We'll continue tomorrow about how to use the sort of angelic non-determinism to do interactive synthesis, sort of in interactive programming.